For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting an announcement anticipated in hours on Iran nuclear talks. An announcement on the status of the Iran nuclear talks in Vienna is expected in the next hours as six world powers and Iran continue negotiating on the future of Iran's nuclear program to ensure it has no military dimensions. Several self-imposed deadlines to reach a comprehensive agreement have come and gone, but progress is reported. John Kirby is a U.S. State Department spokesman.
There's been genuine progress made. I think Secretary Gary believes that, and he said as much, that we're close. But there still remains some sticking points, some issues that still need to be resolved. And so we'll see where they go. But our focus is on what's going on inside the negotiating room.
A White House spokesman indicates negotiators would remain at the table as long as the discussions between Iran and the six countries are productive. Speaking Monday in Ethiopia's capital, where he's attending an international conference, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on both sides in the South Sudan conflict to give up war for the sake of the people and the future of the country. Mr. Ban called for compromise between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar as the country marked its fourth anniversary of independence.
True leadership means making compromises. It means stopping the fighting, stopping the killing and raping, stopping the destruction of the country. A peace in South Sudan also requires support from its neighbors. I urge President Museveni and President Bashir to use their influence on the parties to help end this conflict.
South Sudan has been plagued by violence since December 2013. That's left thousands dead and millions displaced. This is VOA News. Investors worldwide have reacted positively to news of an agreement on a third bailout package worked out between Greece and its international lenders under terms of the Brussels Pact reached early Monday. The Greek parliament will have to approve austerity measures by Wednesday before Greece's creditors begin talks on handing Athens a new $95 billion bailout, which would be its third in the last 5 years. Eurozone chief Jorin Dijsselbloem said he thinks it will take weeks for a new bailout program to be worked out.
This is very complex. We looked at a number of possibilities, but there are technical, legal, financial and political issues to consider. So we have tasked an ad hoc working group of technical experts to look into that. They have already started today.
On his return to Athens after the marathon negotiations, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras faced a mutiny of his leftist governing coalition as he seeks parliamentary approval for spending and pension cuts and tax hikes. Some lawmakers said they would not support the deal. Iraq Monday announced the start of an offensive to recapture its western Anbar province from Islamic State militants, who control large areas, including the cities of Ramadi and Fallujah. The statement said the operation includes Iraqi troops and Shia and Sunni fighters. Ben Conable, a RAND Corporation Iraq analyst, says it's important not to allow IS to continue controlling Anbar.
They identified Anbar as their primary strategic objective before trying to retake Mosul. So that is a positive step. I think they're also prudent in trying to seize Fallujah before Ramadi, as they've announced, because Fallujah, again, will interrupt their lines of communication. However, I have some concerns that the use of the Hashid forces, the Shia militia forces, particularly if they go in the lead into major Sunni cities in Anbar province, is going to simply inflame the already ongoing Sunni revolt against the government of Iraq.
U.S.-led coalition forces stepped up operations to assist the Iraqi goal of retaking Anbar, with most of the 39 airstrikes in Iraq conducted Sunday targeting area around Ramadi. The espionage trial in Tehran of detained Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian resumed Monday for a third closed-door session, Iran's official media reports. The 39-year-old Rezaian being tried on charges of collecting confidential information and handing it to hostile governments. Rezaian denied the allegations. Suspected al-Shabaab militants attacked a Kenyan police convoy near the coastal city Lamu Monday, where Reuters reports at least two police officers and a civilian were killed. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni reportedly will travel to Burundi Tuesday to begin mediation efforts to try to end ethnic and political violence following President Nkurunziza's controversial bid for a third term. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's president sacks his top military chiefs as Boko Haram launches new attacks.
If a given strategy has been in place for 5-6 years, and it hasn't yielded the kind of results that people want, that is the point at which change should be expected.
Shehu Galba, senior special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. The head of UN mission in the DRC urges a rebel leader there to face justice. Sierra Leone says it has tracked down two escaped Ebola patients. And the United Nations says it supports any effort that will create the atmosphere for elections in Burundi.
You know, obviously, the continuing deterioration of the situation in Burundi is of concern to us. On the political front, we are obviously very much supporting the facilitation efforts by President Museveni.
Stéphane Dujarric is the spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. We will examine the impact of South Sudan's conflict on school attendance. And during this month of Ramadan, we look at what American Muslims are doing to fight negative stereotypes of Islam. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on Monday sacked his top military chiefs, including the Army, Air Force, Navy, and National Security Advisor. The president has appointed six new service chiefs who will be acting until their confirmation by the Senate. No reason was given for the dismissals, which comes as the militant group Boko Haram has recently intensified its attacks. The military command has come under criticism for its handling of the Boko Haram insurgency. Shehu Galba is the senior special assistant to President Buhari on media and publicity. He says the changes are routine for every new government, but at the same time, inevitable.
Well, of course, these appointments, command appointments, they are regime specific. When a government comes, you would expect that they would come in with their service chiefs, and I believe that this is not itself totally unexpected. I'm sure that the service chiefs who had left had longer expected this to come. In fact, the fact that it didn't happen on day one is an indication of the grace that President Buhari has brought to the office. Try to make sure that that we have a good handle on every aspect before he decides to fire them.
This is the president who has yet to completely form his cabinet, and then he's starting with the military. People would say, oh, wait a minute, you have Boko Haram on your hand. Why are you changing the top military chief of your army?
That precisely is the reason why they need to be changed, because if a given strategy has been in place for 5-6 years, and it hasn't yielded the kind of results that people want, that is the point at which change should be expected. So he has injected a fresh new leadership, a fresh new outlook, and a fresh new vision. I believe that this, coming with his determination to end this insurgency within the shortest possible time, you know, all of it will come together and we will hopefully be seeing quicker and better results.
Does this indicate that the military chiefs who have been replaced did not do enough to fight Boko Haram? Because one would argue that perhaps there have been successes by this military against Boko Haram. And then people said recently when your government took over, we started to see a spike in Boko Haram activities.
Well, let me say that the president thanked the people who had just left for their service to the nation. And that is a mark of appreciation. We are looking at the holistic approach to the entire thing, inspired by the former administration that left office. And we campaign on a completely new approach and a vision and a new solution that we are putting on the table. So let's see how this works for the whole country. As for the spiraling of the bombing, it's very clear that this itself is an outcome of the successful eviction of the terrorists from their strongholds.
I read the last time that President Buhari had offered to negotiate with Boko Haram, if Boko Haram was willing to negotiate. Is that true?
I think that that needs to be clarified. The story then was that the government was not averse to a peaceful resolution. No reasonable government would say that they don't want peaceful settlement of any conflict. Other than that, it is about peace. You need partners. You need people who would join you on the table. As it is, we are not seeing anybody on the other side of the table.
So would this make a difference in terms of the military's fight against Boko Haram?
Well, let's see, because there is a holistic approach to the entire thing now, now that everyone, you know, has seen the international nature of the thing, and obviously not one country, there's not one country that can deal with this issue. You know, all of the countries in the Lake Chad Basin area, you know, they have come together, put together a new fighting force, which will go into operation end of this month. So with all of the efforts that the Nigerian government is doing, I'm sure with that coming on stream, you would expect that there should hopefully be a rapid end to the unwanted situation.
Shehu Galba is a senior special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Sierra Leone says it has tracked down two Ebola patients who escaped Saturday from a clinic on the outskirts of the capital, Freetown. Abdoulaye Berete is the national publicity and outreach coordinator in the office of Sierra Leone's government spokesman. He says the government's contact tracers and surveillance officers are trying to find out whether the two patients made any contacts during their escape.
Well, indeed, we had few patients, about two, three of them, who escaped from the red zone at the famous police training school treatment center in the outskirts of Freetown. And when it happened, we became very much concerned, particularly at a time when we are already pushing what we call the Operation Northern Search, whereby Cambia and Port Loko district in the northern part of the country are under curfew as a way of containing the virus. And when this incident happened, we were able to raise all the red flags to our contacts and surveillance teams. And within a couple of hours, we were able to track them within the vicinity of the treatment center itself. Already, they have been readmitted, and they are undergoing treatment.
But what happens now? Because I'm sure they probably came into contact with other people. Are you trying to trace if they have come in contact with anybody?
Well, we have listed all the possible contacts, and from the authorities within the treatment facility, it became very clear that the possibility was very remote that they may have come into contact with anybody within the vicinity itself. But that notwithstanding, we have alerted our contact tracers as well as the surveillance teams within the facility so that they will be able to see any possibility of them coming into contact with anybody. And this includes surveillance, active surveillance for that matter, of all front health line workers that may have come into contact with them.
So if there are curfews imposed in the hard-hit areas of Sierra Leone, how come this is happening? Are the people breaking the curfew or what?
Well, it is an unfortunate situation because what we have done, no sooner President Koroma declared a curfew for those two districts, the military and the police were deployed there with a view to contain. But I think there has been some laxity because the president in his speech did remind the security personnel that in the course of securing those that have been quarantined, they must also understand that those people's human rights must be respected. So I guess that could have contributed to this laxity of security. But we have told them that within the context of the public state of emergency and within the view of trying to contain the virus, we will not entertain any laxity on the part of the security forces. And the president has reiterated that to the chief of staff of the military as well as the inspector general of police.
Abdoulaye Berete is the national publicity and outreach coordinator in the office of Sierra Leone's government spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 14th. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. The head of the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo is expected to brief the UN Security Council today, Tuesday, on the situation in the DRC. Martin Kobler is likely to report little progress by the Congolese military in its operations against Rwandan Hutu rebels known as the FDLR. But he did tell VOA that the group's military commander, Sylvester Mudakumura, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court at The Hague, must face justice.
We do recognize that this is the main operational task now, really, to go after the third largest group now, the FDLR. Unfortunately, the government suspended cooperation after we had some human rights problems, but we are in a very good process of discussion with the government now to resume operations. We do recognize, both the government and MONUSCO, that the FDLR is the major problem and the major stumbling block for peace in the Great Lakes region.
So does that mean there's been any progress made on the FARDC removing the two red-listed generals? Do you think you might be working with them again?
No, it's not a matter of removing red-listed generals. We are in very close cooperation and contact with the government. I'm very confident we find a solution very soon. This does not impede very fruitful cooperation and also military action in other areas, like now the combat since 3rd of June against the FRPI in Ituri.
Today, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for the FDLR military commander Silvestre Mutakamura. So what technical or other assets does MONUSCO have that might facilitate his arrest?
Well, the arrest warrant against Silvestre Mutakamura is out for quite some time. And we always have been in close contact with the ICC to get hold of Silvestre Mutakamura. We also tried at one stage, to convince him to surrender voluntarily to the ICC. It is very important that we stick to the principle of fight against impunity. Silvestre Mutakamura has to get out of the bush. He has to come to us. We will bring him to The Hague. The Hague will take him, and he should face justice.
Turning to the political side, the DRC is scheduled to have presidential elections in November 2016. Have you had any indication from Kinshasa whether President Kabila plans to disregard the constitution and run for a third term, or if he's going to step aside?
No, not at all. President Kabila emphasized several times that the constitution has to be respected, and here we are in the same kind of page, because our resolution given by the Security Council also says very clearly that the constitution has to be respected. The question is, many suspect a kind of delay of the elections, and here our position is very clear. The electoral timetable, the electoral calendar has to be respected. This leads over a series of elections to presidential and legislative elections in November 2016. And the respect for the Constitution, this is really something which is also written in the Constitution given by the Security Council, and we emphasize it whenever we can.
Martin Kobler is the head of the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke to viewers Margaret Bashir at the United Nations in New York. The United Nations says it supports any effort that would create the atmosphere for elections in Burundi, including the mediation efforts of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who is expected in the Burundian capital today, Tuesday. At the same time, Stefan Dujarric, spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, says the United Nations is deeply concerned about the continuing violence in Burundi.
You know, obviously, the continuing deterioration of the situation in Burundi is of concern to us. Our human rights staff is there. They are observing and they are recording what they are seeing. On the political front, we are obviously very much supporting the facilitation efforts by President Museveni. The Secretary General was briefly in touch with him this morning. He expects to speak to him again tomorrow. And we understand that President Museveni is scheduled to be in Bujumbura on the 14th of July. And the Secretary General is obviously using his time in Addis to engage with other regional leaders.
Has there been any shift in kind of the UN's reluctance to pronounce on the constitutionality in terms of the Arusha Accords of this third term? I mean, that essentially is at the heart of this.
Well, I think,
issue.
You know, we are supporting the facilitation that we hope would create the right atmosphere for the elections. We saw the parliamentary elections that took place last week. The UN Electoral Mission expressed its concern at the way the elections were handled and how they took place. We will do the same for the presidential elections, but I think what's important is that we all support the regional efforts.
Stefan Dujarric is a spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He spoke Monday at the United Nations during the daily media briefing. South Sudan's nearly two-year-old civil war has all but ruined the country's educational system, which was already tenuous at best. As Mugumi Davis Rakarinji of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba, the fighting has forced tens of thousands of children to miss school.
At St. Joseph's Primary School in Juba, children head home each day at 3 p.m. Okot Santos, the deputy headmaster of the school, says this was not the normal routine before the conflict began nearly 2 years ago. Students, especially those about to sit for national exams, would usually study for long hours or revise their work on lessons with peers and teachers. Santos remembers one incident back in March when a parent came to pick up his child to go home to Monoki.
The parent of a child in class 8 been sought off by the border, and this has affected the child psychologically in the learning. The support the parents used to give, these supports are now withdrawn. This will affect the progress of the child in learning and even to go further.
Santos says this was traumatic not just for the one child, but for more than 1,300 children studying at the school. And he says insecurity has consequences for the children's future performance.
The candidate classes are always depart late to go home by 5 or 5.30. Because of the fear people have and the distances they have, we stop at 3. This limits the numbers of hours for learning. When you look at the overall effect, it will affect education. The coverage will not be enough. The children will do examination when the syllabus is incomplete.
Natalie Fiona Hamudi, UNICEF specialist for emergency education, agrees. She says teachers have been equally affected by the conflict. Some of them have been forced to abandon their schools and flee their communities, putting more pressure on already strained teaching staffs.
There was already about 1 million children who were out of school, which we were trying to bring back to learning. But the fighting in the Free State had created more dropouts. So more than 500,000 children have dropped out of school in mainly Free State, Jonglei, Upper Nile and Unity. And close to 1,200 schools have closed in this Free State.
UNICEF says more than 80 schools are still being occupied by soldiers on both sides who store artillery in the school buildings. Even before the conflict began, the literacy rate in the country was dismal. According to the National Bureau of Statistics, the national literacy rate in 2013 stood at only 27% in South Sudan. The primary school enrollment rate was just 47%, and barely 10% of those students completed their studies. Both Santos and Hamudi believe the only way for the South Sudanese children to achieve their aspirations is for the conflict to end. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
As the Muslim holy month of Ramadan draws to a close later this week, one community east of Los Angeles, USA, is trying to reach out to non-Muslims and show them what international news is not saying about their faith. Correspondent Elizabeth Lee has this report from Chino in California.
The month of Ramadan is a time when Muslims fast and focus on God. And in the town of Chino, at the Bethel Hamid Mosque, it is also a time when Muslims and some non-Muslims find themselves in a similar plight, says Chino Police Chief Karen Comstock.
We as law enforcement professionals share in your same plight. Because every day on the news, you're watching the secular media tell you a story about law enforcement and policing that I'm telling you is wrong. There are men and women in this profession, which I love so much, that are performing with a high degree of professionalism and accuracy and protecting the very community you live in.
Similar to media coverage of over-policing in the United States, many Muslims, including Ahmadiyya Muslim Community Los Angeles East Chapter President Asin Mahmoud Khan, say news of Islamic extremists in the Middle East and around the world does not reflect who they are.
You hear a lot in the news about ISIL or ISIS and what's going on in the Middle East. It's just terrible, and we hear this in the news every day. And it's very similar to what happened post 9/11 with what was going on with Al-Qaeda, where you had this juxtaposition. You had those who claimed to be Muslim doing the most heinous acts and proclaiming the name of Allah and the name of the Holy Prophet and doing such horrible things. And then you have a community like ours.
The Ahmadiyya Muslim community, unlike most Muslims, believes its Messiah arrived in the 19th century. A few years ago, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community started a campaign in the U.S. called Muslims for Loyalty. Khan says its messages a devout Muslim can also be a loyal American.
Is a way for us to reach out to the communities around the world and show that as Muslims, we're also loyal to our nation.
The imam of the Bethel Hamid Mosque, Mohammed Zafarullah, says Islam is a religion of peace, but that extremists tarnish his faith.
Those people who are doing all these kind of things, they say they are Muslim, but according to our religion, they are not a real Muslim, because they have their own agenda, which they are using the name of the religion.
Some Muslims here say they are concerned some of the younger generation in other parts of the world may be affected by extremism.
The only way to counter this negative image that may be conveyed to the young people is for our own youth to engage in setting the record straight.
This Ahmadiyya Muslim community says, for the record, their faith is one of love, loyalty, and peace. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Chino, California.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Nigerian Commonwealth Games long jump champion Brume Ese won women's long jump with a distance of 6.61 meters at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meeting in Akure, Ondo State, Southwest Nigeria on Saturday. Blessing Ibrahim Ibukun won women's triple jump with a leap of 13.65 meters, while Okpara Tedas won the men's long jump in 7.54 meters. On the track, Adeloye Oluwatosin prevailed in the women's 400 meters in 52.31 seconds as Nathaniel Sampson won the men's race in 46.37 seconds. Daisy Akpofu won women's 400 meter hurdles in 58.29 seconds as Samuel Okori carried the men's race in 51.62 seconds, while Divine Oduduru won men's 200 meters in 21.08 seconds. Turning to football, Japan edged Senegal 4-3 at the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup in Espinho, Portugal on Monday. Today, Tuesday, African champions Madagascar play Paraguay. Meanwhile, Ethiopia held their hosts Cameroon to a scoreless draw in Africa FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup qualifier in Yaoundé on Sunday. Nigeria overpowered Liberia 7-1. The Democratic Republic of Congo mauled Namibia 4-0. Ghana thrashed Senegal 6-0. South Africa outclassed Botswana 8-1. Equatorial Guinea dismissed Mali 4-0. Burkina Faso edged Algeria 2-1. And Zambia outplayed Tanzania 4-0. Meanwhile, hosts Maghreb Tetouan and the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe drew 0-0. In a mini-league Orange Africa Champions League action in Tetouan on Monday morning. In Tunisia, Polish tactician Henry Kasperzak takes the reign as Tunisia's national football coach. The Tunisia Football Federation revealed in Tunis on Monday. Kasperzak, who coached Tunisia in the mid-1990s, takes over from Belgian George Likens. Finally, in volleyball, African champions Kenya beat Peru by 3-1 in the final of their Women's World Volleyball Grand Prix tie in Canberra, Australia on Saturday. Earlier on, Kenyans dismissed Australia 3-1 in the semi-final. Consequently, Kenya is ranked 21st, while Algeria is 27th among the 28 teams in the Grand Prix circuit. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has replaced his entire military top brass to boost the fight against Boko Haram militants as the group continues to launch new attacks. That is it for this Tuesday, July 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
African music hits.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African music mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, President Obama soon makes his last trip to Africa as president. he will attend the Global Entrepreneurial Summit in his ancestral homeland, Kenya. He will also travel to the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, will join him. And she will be Shaka Sali's guest next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.